You're listening to 90.7 FM, WFUV in New York, public radio from Fordham University. My name's Ben Soper. Thanks for joining us today. And a moment that I've been looking forward to for quite some time has come around. I'm delighted to have Kate and Anna McGarrigle as my guests this afternoon. Welcome.
Hello, hi. Ben.
It's great to have you here. Lovely to have a new album from you guys, too. It's been a worthwhile wait for us to have Matapedia come out. And you're here with your band. Would you like to perform something for us?
Yes, we would. We are going to start with the second track in the album. it's called...
No, not.
Not the second track. I'm sorry. And which track is it?
I'm not sure which track.
Anyhow, it's called... Yeah. You better tell us. Yeah,
it's called Why Must We Die.
That's right. Not Harlan.
Thank you.
We are men of constant sorrow. We'll have trouble all our days. We never found our Eldorado.
Very nice. It's a song from the new album, Matapedia. Kate and Anna McGarrigle join me live today on 90.7 FM, WFUV. And unusual, I guess, in the fact that the two of you wrote the song together. Now, oftentimes...
I was going to say, and also Joel.
And Joel as well. Joel on fiddle.
Yeah.
And Michelle is here with us on bass as well. Now, so the three of you wrote it together. It's unusual because when you come to write a song... When you look at the songs that the two of you have done, historically, oftentimes they are individual songs. One of you has done it, not a collaboration. Is it? Do you find it's difficult or challenging for you to sort of write together?
No, I find it really easy, and it's lovely to have help.
That's because she writes most of it, and she'll say, does anybody have a line for the second line here? That's a collaboration.
Well, oftentimes, you know, I mean, when we go out on the road, we'll say, oh, God, we have to play some new stuff, and the songs are kind of half-written, and so you kind of write them as you go along, as you're rehearsing, and, you know, there's even, you know, sometimes songs never actually get finished, but you record them anyway.
Right. Do you find the arrangements change then?
We'll write the sequel.
Right. So the arrangements change as well while you're out on the road? Do you find that perhaps the very spirit of a song can be turned around?
We tend to get more introverted on stage. It's just as you really know the stuff very, very well, you start trying little things out on your individual instrument, and you start get kind of tripping on that a little bit, you know, and just kind of enjoying. And not the whole arrangement, it's just the whole subtlety of the song. It generally kind of gets less boisterous and more kind of intimate in some ways.
So you're very much sort of working or improvising yourself rather.
Yeah, you got to really know the song very well. Yeah. Like, you have to do it like every night on the stage, and then suddenly you hear, oh, God, Michelle's changed his bass part a little bit, and oh, Anna's done this, oh, Joel's, you know, you start listening to what everybody's playing, you realize everybody's thinking and playing and having a good time. You know?
Right. Well, I think a lot of folks' introduction to you guys may have come through other people's renditions of your songs. Now, your songs are very personal. They touch on, of course, sort of very fairly universal themes, too, but they are very, as you say, very introspective, very personal songs. Have you ever written for other people, or do you always write for yourself? It's always much more of a personal thing.
We've attempted some writing for film, but usually it's snippets of music. It's never like a whole song. We've tried to write a musical to collaborate with somebody else. We wrote a bunch of songs, and we never got a book that fit the songs that we wrote. So that was really writing for somebody else. But you always put yourself certainly in the lyrics.
I know that a while back, probably 6-7 years or so, I read a review where you mentioned that you had a musical that you were working on at the time.
That's the one she's talking about.
Yeah,
it's shelved for the moment.
It is shelved for the moment. But I'd imagine writing in that situation, as you're saying, is very much more sort of for someone else. It's for someone else to sing.
Yeah.
It's much easier to collaborate and stuff like that, because suddenly you have this, the thing we were writing was about a woman who made a lot of money and lost it all and died in jail in the 19th century. So suddenly we were kind of like, we had this image of this character or something. You know, some of his sorrows are Ethel Merman or something like this. And we kind of like giving her these ballads to belt out, you know.
Right.
You can't really do that with yourself.
Wow. Was the thing, so was it completed, first of all? Has the musical been completed?
Yeah, we had a song that started it and a song that ended it and all the stuff in between. Yes.
But there's no book.
There's
a slight problem.
No movie yet.
No movie yet.
Kate and Anna McGarrigle, my guest today on City Folk at WFUV. And speaking of other people's renditions, probably the most recent is Emmylou Harris's Going Back to Harlan, your song, which is now shown up on Matapedia, the new album.
Right.
You had worked with her too, and Daniel Lanois. How did that come about?
Well, she heard us singing the song about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago in Toronto, and she happened to be there making a video, I guess, for another record that she had released. And she liked it, and she said, could you please send us a tape? And it was brand new, so we made a demo tape at Michelle's little studio and sent it down. And anyway, it was supposed to be on her the second trio record that she was making with Linda Ronstadt and Dolly Parton. And that thing, that project fell apart. So she put it on her record, and she called us down to sing. We actually sang on the song, but they didn't use our voices because they went with an earlier mix. But we ended up by singing on her song at the end of the record.
Right. I was wondering why that was the case, why you went on your own song.
Well, we sang on two or three things, and even one, I think, that didn't get put on at all, something of his that she had done. And anyway, but apparently there's a documentary that his brother filmed, like through Daniel Lanois' brother Bob filmed while everybody came down, and people
really?
Have seen, and they use a section where we sing on Going Back to Harlem.
Wow, I'd love to try and find that.
Yeah, in fact, the guy that was putting the movie together called me last week. He said, why didn't they use that part? It sounded beautiful. And I said, because, I don't know, they liked an earlier mix.
So how familiar with Daniel Lanois, and I mean, I'm sure both of you were pretty familiar with Emmylou Harris at the point. How familiar with Daniel Lanois' music and his style, if you like, were you by that point?
I think mostly I was familiar with him because of my kids and my daughter loving you too. And I guess because of the Bob Dylan record.
Oh,
and,
mercy, yeah.
And what else?
I think also
because Pierre Nardin.
Yeah, the producer we had on our last, on the Heartbeats Accelerating, had been suggested by Daniel Lanois.
Oh, really?
He had worked with him and with Michelle for a girl in Montreal called Luba.
Hmm. Yeah, they were all in a band together.
And that's how we got to know Pierre Marchand, because he had suggested, Daniel suggested Pierre, and then Pierre introduced us to Michelle. So, I mean, it's kind of like this. Well, mafia going on.
producers clique going on there. But Pierre is, of course, a wonderful music producer,
yeah.
too. And as you say, produced Heartbeats, has produced a couple of tracks on the new album.
That's
well,
right, that's right.
Giving his touch to it. So how did you feel, returning to the, you know, Daniel's interpretation of it and Emmylou's, of course, how did you feel once you heard the final take of Going Back to Harlem? It must have been quite amazing, I would have thought.
You mean when we heard her version?
Yeah.
Well, it was a shock, but it was nice that they had sort of done something completely different with it. And I must say that when Keith and I went down, we just had a very, very sort of rough mix of what we had done.
We liked it. We were very proud of it.
Yeah, we liked it very, but the thing is, it was so overwhelming going into that studio, and of course they play everything at like a very high volume, and they played the entire record, and then afterward Emmylou said, hey, did you guys bring down anything? We said, oh no. We didn't have anything that was fine, you know, that had final mixes, and we only had a little cassette, and they probably would have played it on a blood box or something.
Right.
You know, I mean, and it would have sounded quite diminished.
You never really know if those people, sometimes like they're very, it's kind of very opulent down there, and this whole kind of New Orleans vibe, and the beads hanging over the place, and candles lit and all that, and you never know if they're going to do something. If you put your little tape on, they're just going to like run you into the ground, kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like you get shy in places like that. You kind of don't want to be vulnerable, you don't want to put your neck out.
Put your neck too far out there.
But it was fun to go back and, you know, work with Michelle and Joel back in Montreal.
Without the candles and the beads.
And what a great result, too. Matterpedia just out. As of about a month or so ago, Kate and Anna McGarrigle joining me today. Would you like to have a crack at another song?
The number two song. This time
this
I
is,
made a, Going Back to Harlem.
This is the one.
The one. Okay, Anna. I'm going to count it in.
3, 4. Thank you.
heart apart and play me a little shady girl. Ring bells are grimly, feel they ring inside my head forever. Bounce the ball, rock the gallows for the hangman's dream. And wake the devil from his dream. I'm going back to Harlem. I'm going back to Harlem. I'm going back to Harlem.
Wow, it's great to hear that. Going Back to Harlem, one of the songs off the new album Matterpedia that is just out from Kate and Anna McGarrigle. They're my guests today on City Folk at WFUV. And just wonderful to hear those sibling harmonies. There's something really special, I think, about folks who have grown up together, who sing together. And you know, there are traditionally not too many sibling groups that are around these things. Yeah, all that get along, I guess.
I think that's
who says we get along.
Well, we're here.
You are indeed. First album for a little while. Now, of course, it's it must be wonderful to sort of have enough time, enough space to craft songs and spend a good amount of time doing it. It's been, I guess, about 6 years since Heartbeats Accelerating,
that's
which
right.
was the last album. Yeah. Do you find that songs come quickly, Anna? Do songs come fast? Are they a quick process?
Not as fast as they used to. No, I have to have total quiet. I can't have, you know. I mean, there's a lot of chaos in my life because there's four people living in a house and a dog, and we have chickens outside, and there's all kinds of teenagers. Friends and that, you know, in and out of the house. So I find that I don't write very much at home. I wait to get to a nice quiet studio where we're already working on something else.
Right.
I'll get an idea for a song, or in the car or something else.
Does it strike you like that? Are you just sort of, you know, pottering around the house doing things and then suddenly you get an idea for a song?
Yeah, it is like that.
Mm.
But not necessarily in my house anymore. Before, I used to get a lot of ideas in the house, but now there's too many people in the house.
I'm curious, actually, as to which one of the two of you was the first to take up songwriting. As was it something that you, Kate?
No, it was Anna. Anna wrote Hard Like Oil in 1969.
Yeah.
I thought you wrote something before.
Well, I never used it. No, I mean, I didn't. Nothing.
I guess we started writing around the same time, but Kate actually sort of had a quasi-career
69?
For about a year. Yeah.
1970.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the two of you weren't working together until
no.
around about that point. So Heart Like a Wheel, you wrote it in 69. It's your first songwriting attempt?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, it's not. What happened is that we had this old piano at home, and everybody, we always tell the story that there was always somebody playing the piano. But the thing is, I never played that piano unless I had to do my, you know, piano exercises for school. And once I found myself there with my mother, and my father had died, so he wasn't playing it anymore. Janie, our other sister, moved away to New Brunswick or San Francisco or something. And Kate had moved away to New York, and finally the piano was there, so I could
all
sit
yours.
Down and play.
And just one day you were sitting around and came up with Heart Like
Something
Wheel.
Like that.
Wow. So Kate, you were already in New York City at that point.
Oh, I got down with a friend. When I finished school, I didn't really realize I didn't want to work. I finished in science. I didn't want to really work as anything. So,
right. So
having
really
never
down.
Worked in my life, I didn't want to. So I went down to New York with a friend, and we just kind of hung around and looked in coffee houses and tried some. She was a terrific schmoozer. She knew some people, and I kind of learned to schmooze by following her around. And then I called Anna up. I said, there's all kinds of people here playing songs and writing songs, and, you know, it's... Because we had done some work at home when we were younger, like when we were teenagers, we used to work in a folk group, so we could sing together, and we could sing and play instruments and stuff like that. So, and I was just kind of interested in this whole singer-songwriter thing, just because I I thought maybe at that point, since I didn't want to be a scientist, maybe I'd try and change directions in my life.
Just sort of give it a shot. So it was kind of like almost a whim for you at that point. You were just sort of following
a
different path.
Well, the thing is, we had done a lot of music in Montreal, but in Montreal, there was never an industry there or anything. You really did it for the fun of it. I mean, you didn't go out in the clubs and play clubs to be discovered, because there was nobody there to discover you.
Right.
So by the time I think I got to New York, I was 22, I was kind of realizing that the scale of the stuff that we were doing back in Montreal, that we had done, Anne and I and these other guys that we'd worked with, was very sophisticated compared to what I was hearing. That's why I called Anne up and I said, I'm amazed that some people here are getting deals that aren't, you know.
And they can't even play a proper
chord. No, they couldn't. No. I mean, no, kind of like I was. Then I realized, I thought, and they were being signed, and the people in New York would, I don't know, agents would go and hang out of the Gaslight, and people like that would see who was coming through town, see what the talent was. And I realized that it's something that you could actually make a living at, or, you know, or at least give it a shot.
Right, right.
That was it. That was kind of the attitude. Why not?
Yeah. Wow. So the two of you are down. So you're here in New York writing songs, and you bring with you Hot Like a Wheel, and then presumably Linda Ronstadt picks it up, and in 1974 it's...
Yeah, but it was a few years before she picked it up, I think.
I used to sing it in 1970 around New York. Yeah. I worked with this girl called Roma Baron, who is now a lawyer. We'd done it on stage, and I think a group called McKendree Spring had heard it. They recorded in 1972, I think it was. And so it was the first time I had to issue a license. I had to ask Anna, so we had to issue a license. And then Jerry Jeff Walker, we opened for him in the fall of 1970. And he heard the song, and he said, boy, I think that would be very good for Linda Ronstadt. And we gave him a tape.
Mm.
And we're not really sure how she got the song, whether it was from him or she'd heard the other record. So that was the kicked off the career.
That started it. Wow, well, and you know, I guess that sort of brought a lot of people to the attention of yourselves, which is a wonderful thing, from the first debut back in 1975, and various different things that you've been doing since. Now, one of the things that has really was very much ahead of its time, or at least struck me as being so, was the French record, which was third or fourth release that you'd done, investigating very much that side of your heritage, and has popped up on other albums. You've often collaborated and come up with French songs, and there is indeed one on the new album too. Is it something that you've always felt very strongly about, something that you've always wanted to bring out?
Well, we were asked to make a French record, because at that point, in 1980, we weren't really on the Warner Brothers label anymore. In living in Quebec, you know, where most people speak French, and actually liked the French songs that we had on our record, and were also half French. The guy thought, well, maybe it would be a good idea to put one out just for that market, which we did. And
but I think writing French.
That's right. I think the first song we wrote in French was a song called Complaint pour Sainte-Catherine, but we had written it for another project, and he and I wrote it, this is my friend Philippe Tatarchev, wrote in 20 minutes.
Wow.
So we knew we could do that. And then we made another one for somebody, a big singer up there who's like a big belter, a huge voice, a woman called Ginette Renault. And we wrote the song. But of course, we never got it to her. And we ended up by singing it ourselves on our second record.
So there's an instance of a song that was sort of more written for someone else, I suppose.
No, but we had her in mind.
But, right, yeah. Okay, I see what you're saying.
We never actually gave it to her, because at that point, you know, everything happened very quickly, you know. We already had a deal, and then we had already made a record. And
it's also different, though. I mean, when Philippe writes lyrics, he's very much he's studied a lot of French literature, and he's actually Swiss background. And you can say to Philippe, "I have an idea for a song." He almost kind of approaches it as a craft. It's not like he's not pouring his soul out in the song. He's actually taking your idea and putting it into lyrics. So.
Mm.
So I mean, it's a little bit.
He's almost too cynical to be romantic. So there's always like a little sort of cynical thing about every song that he writes.
Right. He He's a poet, not a songwriter, we should point out, too.
Well, he is a songwriter, actually. He's written a whole bunch of songs in English, too, and even tried to get a record deal, but mailed out 300 copies of a little record he put out himself.
Mm. Kate Nana McGarrigle here with me today at WFUV. Would you like to do another song for us? And I think it entails a quick moving around here.
Yeah, quickly move.
While you're doing that, I'll take the opportunity to mention that you are in town to perform on Friday night, the 15th of November. You'll be at Symphony Space doing a show up there at 8 p.m. It's on the Upper West Side, Broadway and 95th. Our own midday host, Freddie Houston, will be there to host that one. And if you want to find out more information, the Symphony Space box office is 212-864-5400. That's this Friday, Symphony Space, presented by New Audiences and WFUV. That's a lovely accordion, Anna.
It actually isn't. It's a horrible accordion. It looks nice because you see you were fooled because it's painted gold and black.
I think I was suckered by the color scheme
right.
There.
No, it is. It's a nice idea. I think it's based on some old sort of, I don't know,
give me
arts and crafts thing.
Well, it's a...
It's like stencils, yeah.
It's a button accordion, which is, you know, one of... Right,
yeah.
Diatonic. So do you play piano accordions as well, or is button really a thing?
Yeah, we just use these for company. We're not sort of wizards on them.
So it's more for the drone and the sort of...
Right,
understanding.
Yeah.
I can't even tell if I'm remotely in tune. Up or down?
Accordion?
Oh,
we love this, though. This is the sort of stuff we very much enjoy.
It's good to be tuned. There's people turning off the radio.
This really is not... We're just playing a background tape to give you the illusion of it.
That's right. It's all a big hoax.
These are not my notes, these are your notes.
Do you want to give some more weather reports?
Can I hear your notes, Michelle, on the bass, please?
She was not afraid.
The title track to the new album. It's called Matapedia. Kate and Anna McGarrigle are my guests today here at 90.7 FM, WFUV. I'm Ben Soper, and you're listening to City Folk. A song from the new album that we've been discussing slightly, that Martha, in fact, your daughter, sings on. Now, does Martha have songwriting aspirations? Do the kids have aspirations too?
Do my kids have aspirations? My son's already signed to DreamWorks.
Oh, really? I didn't know
that. That's a big aspiration.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, he's 23. His name is Rufus Wainwright.
Right.
And Martha is, yes, she's written about 7 or 8 songs now. And she's a very good. And she sounds a little bit like, me. She looks a bit like me. At least this guy thought she looked like me. Yeah, she has. She writes songs, but they're very much like her father's songs.
Do you encourage that? I guess you must have. She's, you know, you feel that it's a, because the industry is obviously something that's a dodgy area, but as a songwriter and from your experiences, is it something that you feel?
Well, I have to explain. Her father is a songwriter. Mm-hmm. Well, the father, Loudon Wainwright, he's the father of Rufus and Martha, and at one point, she was going to this fancy girls' school in Montreal, and Loudon said to the headmistress, perhaps Martha would like to be a lawyer or a doctor or something like that. And Mrs. Marshall, who was the headmistress, looked Loudon in the eye and said, Mr. Wainwright, 90% of kids do what their parents do.
Oh.
And, I mean, we just... and. So I'm not surprised.
At that point, the die was cast.
Right,
it's interesting that Loudon didn't do what his father did. His father was a writer with Life magazine, and, well, I guess in a way he is a writer.
Well, in a way, he kind of the same thing. I mean, what he writes about is not unlike his stuff his father wrote about. Like,
it's almost
little
like
everyday
he,
things, yeah.
Right. Except he expresses it through a guitar and up on stage as opposed to being in a magazine.
Yeah. It was very similar, almost like journalism in a certain way.
Well, yeah, I guess in a way it is, because Loudon songs do tend to sort of, you know, spotlight certain experiences.
The everyman kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Anna, how about your kids? Do they follow in your footsteps too?
They're musical, but I must confess that I haven't pushed them in any direction.
Are you suggesting I have?
Maybe just a nudge here and there, Kate. No, I haven't, but I mean, I know they're musical, so I'm not,
right.
If they want to do it, they can do that if they want to. But I don't think they love the stage quite as much as Kate's kids do, and as Kate says, it's because their two parents are, you know, on stage.
Right.
And I've always been sort of like the reticent one, although I'm sort of comfortable there now on the stage.
I don't know if being shy buys you anything.
Anyway, so I don't know what they'll do.
Well, it's been terrific to have you guys up here with us
today. Thank you.
And we're looking forward very much to Friday night's performance at Symphony Space. It's great to have you back in town. I guess the last time that a lot of folks got a chance to see you is when you were Joan Baez's guests at the Bottom Line for that series of shows. Maybe not the last time, but one of the more recent ones. Very quickly, how did that happen? Was it something that she had, obviously you have a history with her, but
we didn't have, no, nothing at all. Just her manager, Mark Spector, called us up and said he was in Connecticut. This was about 2.5-3 years ago. He said, "We're putting together a live record for Joan, and we're having guests on it, and she would like to." He said, "I found this song called Le Prince d'Orange, which was done by a group called Malicorne, who are a French group."
Sure.
And he said, "I thought it would be nice if Joan did the song with you, and I realized you guys sing in French, and Joan sings beautifully in French." So we all ended up in New York together, and then realized that she really didn't know the song, and we didn't know the song. We didn't want to, like, we had very little time to rehearse, like maybe a couple of hours.
Mm.
So we decided to scrap the Le Prince d'Orange, and we happened to just all know Willie Moore, which is a folk song. Only she knew it was with Fair Annie, we knew it was Fair Ellen, but other than that, we knew the same song.
Right.
You know?
Willie was still Willie.
Willie was Willie. He was just fooling around with a couple
extra people, though,
right.
Wow. So, and then, you know, right up on stage, and that was it. It was over after that one night.
Yeah.
Have you entertained ideas of working with her again and sort of getting?
She
back?
Hasn't asked us.
She hasn't.
No.
But it was very. It was lovely. We were sitting up there beaming, listening to her sing, and we looked at each other, and we said, "She sounds just like Joan Baez." Well, she is Joan Baez. Yeah.
It really was. I mean, it was that kind of feeling that we had. It was just.
Yeah.
She's very distinctive.
Yeah, she's a remarkable woman.
Mm-hmm.
So we asked you, or I asked you right at the beginning here, for sort of a guest DJ pick. And often what happens is when you get more than one person in a situation like this and you say guest DJ pick, and everybody sort of looks at each other and it's difficult to come up with a consensus. But, Anna, you came up with an idea here.
Oh, yeah, because it was sort of on the subject of children, of, you know, of artists, and I was asking Joel the other day in the car today, what did Jacob Dylan sound like? Did he sound like Bob? And he said, well, he looks sort of like Bob, and he sort of sounds like, so we'd like to hear something by him.
So this is the Wallflowers here at 90.7, Kate and Anna McGarrigle's picks. Thank you guys for coming up to WFUV. And you should have seen their faces when they heard it too. Kate and Anna McGarrigle, their pick is One Headlight from the new Jacob Dylan and the Wallflowers album, Bringing Down the Horse. Here at 90.7 WFUV, Ben Soper, my thanks to them. Once again, you will be able to catch them this Friday night at Symphony Space. They'll be doing an 8 p.m. show. Kate and Anna McGarrigle back in town with the new album, Matapedia.